Chiefs say during the past 24 hours, hospitals have received 8 bodies recovered from under the rubble. The death toll from the genocidal war since October 2023 has risen above 70,120. More than 171,000 others have also been injured. Moti Abu Musabe joined us earlier from Deir al-Bala with the latest update on Israeli attacks in the Gaza Strip.
The Israeli violations of the ceasefire agreement are still ongoing. More airstrikes were carried out in the southern parts of Gaza Strip. Many of them were carried out in the eastern side of Rafah City. In addition to that, the eastern section of Khan Yunis City was under heavy bombings of the Israeli fire jets, in addition to the Israeli artillery strikes as well. And here in the central area of Gaza Strip, the Israeli occupation forces also continued their mass shooting towards Palestinian people who are taking shelter in the eastern sides of Al Buraij refugee camp, leaving several Palestinian casualties. And when it comes to Gaza City, the Israeli attacks are still ongoing with no sign of abating. We are talking about more Palestinian residential buildings that were demolished and destroyed by the Israeli occupation forces, coupled with the extensive gunfire towards the Palestinian people in At-Tufah neighborhood, which is still one of the focal points of the genocidal and repetitive violations of the ceasefire agreement. I would like to remind you once again that since this ceasefire agreement came into effect, the Israeli violations have exceeded 600, as you know, flagrant violations of the ceasefire agreement, and this toll and this record is still going up, because we are talking about a real intensification of those attacks against various parts of Gaza.
Among the ruins of Gaza's academic institutions, students have begun returning to what remains of their campuses, trying to challenge the Israeli systematic campaign to dismantle the territory's educational infrastructure. Gada Ibrahim has a report.
Students have begun returning to the shattered campuses of Gaza's universities, reopening notebooks among collapsed lecture halls in another act of defiance against the near-total collapse of the territory's higher education system.
The Islamic University is back to schooling today, sending a strong message of hope and determination. During the genocidal war, the Israeli army has deliberately destroyed most of the university's buildings and facilities. However, for us and for our people, education is a priority despite all the challenges. Now we've managed to reopen engineering, sciences, and nursing sections.
The devastation is perhaps most evident at the Islamic University of Gaza, once the largest academic institution in the territory, where buildings have been reduced to rubble, laboratories destroyed, and libraries set ablaze.
We are back to school again. Despite the challenges and the crises unfolding in every aspect of life, despite the transportation crisis and the lack of possibilities, we insist to continue learning. It is their target to decimate our education systems, but we are here to challenge them.
The students have returned, despite the challenges of lacking learning materials, electricity, and coming on foot from distant areas.
Today marks our first day back after 2 years of genocide. The university lies in ruins, yet we are eager to return and continue the educational journey we began. The challenges are immense, both for the institution and for us as students. We navigate destroyed roads with great difficulty from our displacement areas, but there is a sense of relief in finally reclaiming a normal life.
In the ruins of Gaza's shattered campuses, the act of learning has become an assertion of existence, an insistence that even amid wreckage, an educated future is still worth striving for. Adam Rahim, Gaza City, Palestine.
Moving on to Iraq now, where the country has launched an urgent investigation after Lebanon's Hezbollah and Yemen's Ansarullah resistance groups mistakenly appeared on its funds freeze list for terrorism. A publication, Prime Minister Mohammed Shia al-Sudani says, contain inaccurate language and does not reflect state policy.
In a shocking development, Iraq's official newspaper published a set of government decisions, the most notable of which was the freezing of assets belonging to Lebanon's Hezbollah and Yemeni's Ansarullah resistance groups, and listing them as a terrorist organization. The Iraqi government quickly issued a statement, though the Prime Minister Mohammed Shia Sudani denying the decision, while directing an urgent investigation to identify those who were responsible for the mistake.
I believe what happened is a mistake that affects the dignity, will, and conscience of Iraq and Iraqis. Acknowledging the mistake is good, but addressing those responsible, punishing them, and investigating those behind them is necessary. At the same time, there should be vigilance because in the future, there might be greater embarrassment for the government and state, which could harm the reputation of the Iraqi people.
As Sudani affirmed that the Iraqi government is dealing with this error with a full seriousness, stressing that it does not reflect Iraq's real position and that the corrective measures must be taken to fix the course and prevent such mistakes from reappearing in official decisions in the future. Meanwhile, observers believe that this list may have been an attempt to court the United States.
We were taken by surprise in media and political circles when a decision emerged from the Anti-Money Laundering Committee, formed by the General Secretariat of the Council of Ministers, whose outcomes were published in the official newspaper. Upon verification, it became clear that the decision included placing Lebanon's Hezbollah and Yemen's Ansarullah on the terrorism list and freezing their assets. Such a classification contradicts the policy of the Iraqi government, goes against the sentiments and fundamental principles of the Iraqi people, and is inconsistent with the guidance of the religious authorities, which have repeatedly stressed the importance of supporting the Palestinian cause.
The Iraqi Central Bank issued a statement removing Hezbollah and Ansarullah from the list, but a wave of questions has emerged in Iraq about how such incorrect wording made its way into an official document. And as attention turns to the result of the investigation ordered by the Prime Minister, the major question remains, how did these errors reach the official gazette, and what are the potential political implications?
Between denials and political reaction, the most important question remains, was the list issued by the Iraqi government under American pressure following the recent official visit of the U.S. State Department, or was it a mistake as described in the Prime Minister Mohammed Shah Sudani's statement? Nawar Faik, Baghdad.
And in Europe, the national broadcasters of Ireland, Spain, and the Netherlands have announced that they will boycott the 2026 Eurovision Song Contest. The announcement came after the European Broadcasting Union decided to allow Israel to participate in the upcoming competition. The three countries were among several parties that have called for Israel's exclusion, citing the heavy human toll in Gaza and accusations of unfair voting practices. Earlier, Eurovision said it will not hold a vote on Israel's participation in the musical contest. Dodging calls for the regime's ban over its ongoing crimes in Gaza and the occupied West Bank, the decision prompted the three broadcasters to confirm their withdrawal, stating that it does not reflect the ethical values the contest should uphold. Other international bodies, such as the International Federation of Association Football, FIFA, have also sidestepped calls to bar Israel from participation in competition over its genocide in Gaza. Critics say those refusals point to double standards that have shielded Israel from accountability. They cited past actions against countries such as Russia, which was swiftly banned by FIFA and UEFA within days of Russia's attack on Ukraine in 2022. Moving on to New York now, where Iran's UN ambassadors told the General Assembly that unilateral coercive measures constitute clear violation of international law and are tantamount to crimes against humanity. Amir Saeed Iravani said those illegal actions violate human rights principles as they affect daily lives of civilians, including women and children. He added that such measures deprive people of access to medical necessities and other basic needs. Iravani also urged Secretary General Antonio Guterres to appoint a special advisor on unilateral coercive measures. His remarks came as December the 4th marked the International Day Against Unilateral Coercive Measures. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman has commented on today as well. Ismail Baghaei said the U.S. must be held accountable for committing crimes against humanity through the application of illegal and inhumane sanctions against developing countries, including Iran. And Russia's President Vladimir Putin is on a state visit to India. Earlier today, Putin was officially welcomed by the Indian Prime Minister, Narendra Modi. Putin received a guard of honor at the presidential palace in New Delhi. Following the ceremony, the two leaders held talks. The Russian president touched down in India on Thursday for a two-day visit. The agenda of the trip includes defense and technology cooperation. The trip comes against a backdrop of growing pressure from the U.S. on India to reduce its reliance on Russian energy. Washington has accused New Delhi of funding the Ukraine war by purchasing discounted Russian oil. The U.S. has slapped an additional penalty on tariffs on Indian exports as New Delhi ramp up its purchases of Russian oil in the past 3 years. A new survey shows morale inside America's diplomatic corps has collapsed, with most of the U.S. diplomats reporting worsening conditions under President Trump. According to data obtained from the American Foreign Service Association, 98% of professional diplomats reported poor morale. More than 80% said it has become harder to carry out U.S. foreign policy under Donald Trump. The findings highlight the concerns expressed for months by career diplomats and foreign policy experts about the impact of Trump's changes to the State Department and foreign assistance programs. Large-scale layoffs, shrinking resources, and politicization of workforce are among the problems the U.S. Foreign Service has been facing since Trump came into office in his second term. And to get an insight into that topic, we're now joined by Mr. Emmanuel Patrick, President of Asia Institute, joining us live from Tokyo. Welcome to the program. I find it interesting that you are talking to us from Tokyo because we do know that the U.S., even with its ally, has not really been fair. And when we talk about how the U.S., under Donald Trump especially, has been treating both its allies and those the U.S. consider as, you know, adversary, has been really upscale. Give us your intake on what's been happening.
Well, in the specific case of relations with Japan and South Korea, it's clear that the Trump administration and a large number of Americans in government and in finance see those two countries primarily as rivals. And that's related to America's decline in basic science research, its lack of competitiveness, and finally, the damaging effect of immigration policy, which has made it impossible to get the best people to come to America for research. So that's the shift. The specifics, of course, of this decline in diplomacy is related to this effort essentially to destroy the federal government, to fire or dismiss or marginalize everyone with specialized knowledge in the government as a way to basically create complete control by a handful of people.
Okay, many have said that regardless of what you think about the United States, its diplomacy has always been rock solid, and it knows how to balance, you know, using diplomacy or using the, threats of war or sanction. But when it comes to the Trump administration specifically, it seems that the Trump's, you know, whims is overriding the proper channel of communication, especially among diplomats. What do you think and we've seen some, outspoken statements from many career diplomats in the U.S. State Department saying that what the Trump administration is doing goes against even American interest. What does that mean in the long run for the U.S.?
Right. Well, it's both. What's happened since February, when the Trump administration came in full force, firing basically everyone of any competence left and right, reducing the budgets for everything, has been catastrophic. And it's unprecedented in American history. I mean, what's happening right now, the sort of statements of the president and people in State Department calling people from other countries garbage, never happened in American history. However, the slow destruction of diplomacy, of education in the United States has been going on for the last 40 years, and Trump administration is the consequence of that. But under Obama, under Biden, back to the Bush administration, we've seen a slow process in which the economy and international relations have been militarized, and the people who are actually good at cultural, educational efforts to build solidarity and common values have been marginalized. And this is the very sad consequence, and this is actually quite common in the process of declining empires, whether it's the end of the Ottoman Empire, the end of the Roman Empire, or other empires. This is the trend you tend to get at the very end.
Okay. We'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing your views with us. That was Professor Mr. Emmanuel Patrick, President of Asia Institute, joining us from Tokyo. It's always a pleasure to have you on. And that brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin. As always, more is on our website to keep you updated. Thank you so much for joining us. Goodbye for now.
From the heart of beautiful Iran.
Today's special.
Assalamu alaikum.
It's special for you. We present to you today. In the name of Allah, dear brother and sister, salam. You're listening to today's special from IRIB English Radio, and in this episode, we're going to speak about the impact of social media on human interactions. Today is Friday, 14th of Jamadi Thani, 1447 of the Islamic Lunar Hijri calendar, corresponding to the 14th of Azar, 1404 of the Solar calendar, and the 5th of December, 2025 of the Christian Gregorian calendar. We listen to Chapter 3, Verses 133-134
of the Holy Quran. أعوذ بالله وَجَنَّةٍ عَرْضُهَا السَّمَاوَاتُ وَالْأَرْضُ أُعِدَّتْ لِلْمُتَّقِينَ.
And hasten to forgiveness from your Lord, and a garden as wide as the heavens and earth, prepared for the righteous.
الَّذِينَ يُنْفِقُونَ فِي السَّرَّاءِ وَالضَّرَّاءِ وَالْكَاظِمِينَ الْغَيْظَ وَالْعَافِينَ عَنِ النَّاسِ. الناس والله يحب المحسنين.
Who spend in the cause of Allah during ease and hardship, and who restrain anger and who pardon the people, and Allah loves the doers of good.
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله.
Bless your day with contemplation on the verses of the Holy Quran.
This verse introduces the attributes of the pious ones. They spend out in any condition they are in, whether when they are in ease and welfare or at a time when they are in deprivation and adversity. The third attribute of the pious ones mentioned here is that, and who restrain their anger. The fourth quality they have is that, and pardon the faults of men. Their fifth quality is that they are good doers, and the Lord loves the doers of the good. The impact of social media on human interactions is the core of this episode of today's special Be With Us. As digital platforms becomes ingrained in daily life, concerns about social media's impact on mental health and behavior, particularly among young people, have intensified, sparking debates over the need for stricter regulations. In response, governments worldwide are considering policies to limit social media use. Australia, for instance, is introducing age restrictions on social media platforms. In Europe, this initiative mirrors a broader global trend. In Europe, similar measures are under review. Italy and Ireland are considering smartphone bans for minors, while Belgium and the Netherlands have already prohibited phones in schools, citing negative impacts on learning and academic performance.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum and welcome to another edition from series of today's special from Arab English Radio. This is your host, Alif. As for today, we're going to talk about how does social media affect human interaction. Social media often encourages a created and idealized representation of self. The pursuit of likes, shares, and followers can lead to a performance of identity where individuals present a carefully constructed persona rather than their authentic selves. This can lead to feelings of inauthenticity and a disconnect from one's true self. Algorithms prioritize content that is perceived as engaging, often emotionally charged, leading to the increased spread of sensationalized or dramatized content. But here there are some FOMOs. What are FOMOs? Fear of missing out. The constant stream of updates and notifications on social media can create a sense of FOMO, leading individuals to feel anxious or inadequate about their own lives. This anxiety can be exacerbated by the algorithmic amplification of curated content that often showcases idealized lifestyles and achievements. This is related to the concept of availability heuristic, where individuals are more likely to overestimate prevalence of certain events or experiences based on their accessibility in memory, which social media amplifies. But now, what about social comparison envy? This is another case that needs to be discussed and to be paid attention to. Social media platforms often facilitate social comparison, where individuals compare their own lives to those of others. This comparison can lead to feelings of envy, inadequacy, and low self-esteem, particularly when individuals compare themselves to idealized representations of others. The use of image editing software and filters further contributes to the creation of unrealistic standards of beauty and achievement.
Special topics for a special program. You can listen today, now and here, IRIB English Radio. Today's special.
Do's and don'ts on using social media. Don't misrepresent yourself. Dishonesty can have serious personal and professional consequences, even on social media. It might feel easy to misrepresent yourself when you're hiding behind the scene. But even a seemingly innocent embellishment on your LinkedIn profile, such as inventing a more impressive title as a previous job, could get you canned. Using social media to take credit for the achievements of others is also a no-no. Use social media mindfully. Be aware of how social media affects your mood and self-esteem. If you find yourself feeling anxious or inadequate after scrolling through your feed, it may be time to reassess your social media habits. Focus on using social media for meaningful connections rather than as a platform for comparison or validation. And one do-it-yourself background checks. When most people meet someone new for the first time, they often feel a need to reduce uncertainty or learn more about them when deciding whether to form a friendship. This is usually done in three ways: by interacting directly with the person, asking others about the individual, or by observing the person interact with others. But now research has shown that social media has introduced a fourth strategy. Platforms like Twitter and Facebook are particularly rife with uncertainty, reducing information such as personal beliefs, friends and acquaintances, and photographs. This could be useful information to people forming any kind of relationship, but potential employers especially tend to do routine social media searches for job applicants before scheduling a face-to-face interview.
Social media platforms should prioritize user well-being in their design choices and be more transparent about their algorithms. This includes providing users with greater control over their content feeds, limiting the spread of
misinformation and addressing the addictive nature of platform design. Second, data privacy and security. So here, robust data privacy and security measures are essential to protect users from exploitation and abuse. This includes implementing strong encryption protocols, providing users with control over their personal data, and holding platforms accountable for data breaches. And then regulations and oversight are needed to be observed again and to be regulated. Governments and regulatory bodies should play a role in overseeing social media platforms, ensuring that they adhere to ethical standards and protect users' rights. This includes addressing issues such as data privacy, algorithmic bias, and the spread of misinformation.
That was a very essential and interesting topic. So inshallah, we'll continue during these days. Tomorrow, be with us with the same topic. Thank you for listening. That was today's special from IRIB English Radio. And till then, fi amanillah.
So far from you, yet to me you were always so close. I wandered lost in the dark. I closed my eyes to all the signs you put in my way. I walked every day further and further away from you. Ooh, Allah, you brought me home. I thank with every breath I take.
Yani.
Bazaar. Aluminum is the third most abundant metal found on Earth's crust. It is used everywhere, from space capsules to soda cans, but that hasn't always been the case. Surprisingly, aluminum used to be more expensive than gold. In fact, it was so precious that Napoleon used aluminum utensils while dining with guests as a gesture of wealth. Before the 19th century, making aluminum was both expensive and difficult. The new methods for isolating alumina to make the metal were discovered involving electrochemistry. These days, alumina is still continuously studied owing to its vast number of industrial and technological applications. Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of Bazaar, the weekly program that analyzes markets, profits, and all sorts of things that connect us nationally and also internationally. This week, we will talk about the vast world of alumina production, its various uses, and markets. Plus, we will uncover how this seemingly simple item has made broad contributions to knowledge-based product development and the economy as a whole. So let's get started. To become more familiar with alumina and its related products, we visited Altus Alumina. It is a company that specializes in making fused alumina oxide. Now you might be wondering where fused alumina is used. Alumina has a very high melting point and is a crystal-type powder used in grinding, blasting, and cutting processes. Plus, it is an ingredient in various formulations to make things like fire-retardant glass and ceramic glaze. Fused alumina is also used to make various types of catalyst as well. Alumina doesn't quite naturally exist in nature. It is actually synthetically produced, which is no easy task. However, bauxite, which is the raw material alumina comes from, can be found in abundance in the country's mineral reserves. Bauxite ore is extracted from mines. Then it undergoes a refining process that includes digesting it in piping hot sodium hydroxide, where it's also electrocuted. Then it is filtered and fed to a rotary furnace, where it dries at super high temperatures until it becomes a fine crystalline substance. The production facilities of this company are located in Khorasan-e-Razavi province. It is conveniently close to one of the largest bauxite mines in the country, where it gets the majority of its raw material. It might be interesting to know that a lot of the equipment and technology used to make alumina in the country have all been domestically produced. That is significant because this machinery was previously imported through difficult custom processes, which were often time-consuming and, more importantly, very expensive. So indigenizing technology used in knowledge-based industries to produce value-added products is key to expanding the size of related markets. The beating heart of this company is its massive and high-tech research and development department. This knowledge-based company has obtained the technical know-how of producing various grades of alumina. This department carries out studies on the structural, physical, and chemical properties of alumina oxide and improve its performance for different uses. Customers can also make special requests depending on the product they want to make. The research and development department then creates the optimal formula of fused alumina to suit the customer's needs. On another note, while fused alumina is produced in small quantities by other companies, the quality of these productions is often fairly low. This has led industry participants to look to imports to meet their needs. However, this company has saved the country millions in imports while matching international standards for product quality. Presently, this knowledge-based firm is standing on the cusp of exporting its products. It hopes to gain a high share of foreign markets to meet regional demands. This is easily possible as fused alumina is not abundantly produced in the West Asian region and is typically imported into the area. As part of its future vision, this company wants to expand this particular industry to produce high-quality products. It also wants to introduce new items that can be used in down-the-line industries. From laminates and paints to concrete, cement, and tiles, alumina is an important ingredient in numerous products. Iran is a leading producer of many of these items that it also exports to neighboring regions. But alumina is mainly used to make the metal we are all familiar with, which is aluminum. And Iran's market is thriving with aluminum ingot production skyrocketing in recent years. Official figures show Iran is among the top 15 producers of aluminum in the world. Last year, Iran produced over 400,000 tons of aluminum ingots, which is roughly 55,000 tons more than the year before. That is based on figures from the Iranian Mines and Mining Industries Development and Renovation Organization, also known by the acronym IMIDRO. Going off the figures from IMIDRO, the total production of aluminum has roughly doubled over the past 2 years. This comes as aluminum bauxite production surged by well over 13% in the same period. Last year, around 1 million tons of bauxite were produced. Meanwhile, the government is planning on increasing annual aluminum production to 1.5 million tons by the year 2026. This means that alumina production must also increase accordingly. So, how many bauxite reserves are there in the country? Iran has one major bauxite mine, which is located in North Khorasan province. Jojaram mine has an estimated total of 30 million tons of reserves, but only 7 million tons of it are proven reserves. This mine is owned by Iran's sole alumina producing company, which is also owned by IMIDRO. So far, this company has explored and owned nearly 20 bauxite zones in various areas nationwide. But these zones are primarily used as extra feed for the Jojaram alumina refinery. Iran is well known for its copious mineral reserves. In fact, the country has over 60 billion tons of mineral reserves, of which some 40 billion tons are proven reserves. That is based on figures from the National Geological Survey and Mineral Exploration Agency. The Ministry of Mining says the productions in this sector are worth some $22 billion, but so far, productions haven't met this potential value. Industry participants say the country is not using all of its mining potentials. There are several reasons for this. One is the need to further develop the technology and research necessary to expand this sector. Areas that need more attention are geological exploration to discover new reserves and calculating mineable reserves. Plus, there are lucrative investment opportunities for engineering extraction and refining equipment. But that's not all. Once the results are in, related bodies with the know-how to conduct necessary material research are also needed to develop products. And here is where knowledge-based companies, such as the one we just mentioned, play a big role in the mining sector. Presently, there are well over 7,000 knowledge-based companies in Iran. One of this amount, nearly 900 of them, are active in the field of advanced materials and products that are based on chemical technologies. In its transition to a knowledge-based economy, the government has stepped up its support for knowledge-based firms and research institutions. Through the Science and Technology Office and the National Innovation Fund, the government has provided provisions that encourage activities in the mining field. Despite Iran being the third most sanctioned country by the United States, it has made major gains in its industrial developments and added value productions. Such efforts have led to self-sufficiency in many sectors.
All right, everyone, it's time for me to pass it over to my dear friend and colleague out there in the field who has prepared an interesting feature for you. Let's go check it out.
Rich in diverse climatic conditions and creative and talented growers have given Iran a unique potential for production of horticultural crops. Today, we will visit one of the successful companies active in the horticulture business.
Our company, Payovart Asa, is active in business of horticulture. We are a grower of roses and we also build greenhouses. We build modern greenhouses that are suitable for growers who want to improve their productivity and efficiency. We act as an agent for Cordis Rosen Company and propagate at least 100 different types of cut and garden roses in our greenhouses. They are very popular among the growers of roses in Iran because normally they are imported from foreign countries. We are also greenhouse builders. We build wide-span greenhouses that are very suitable for being used in Iran's climate, which is dry and hot. Our company has been in this business for at least 20 years. We have tried to transfer foreign companies' knowledge to Iran.
This company is an affiliate of the Cordis Rosen Company, which is one of the most renowned and innovative breeders of garden roses, cut roses, and pot roses in the world, with a network of agents and licensees in over 30 countries across the globe. Fragrance is often sacrificed by breeders seeking to create disease-free roses, but what makes Cordis roses unique is that, in addition to high marks for being disease-resistant, they also produce rich fragrance and beautiful colors. This company designs, builds, and equips greenhouses based on the types of vegetation growers want to produce. Their main activity is propagating different varieties of roses. They also have different sites in their greenhouses for growing various indoor plants.
Payovart Asa is producing young roses with the same quality as European companies, but at half the price. I think that's the main feature of our company. So instead of importing young roses to Iran, we are exporting them to other countries. The main advantage of our company is that we have transferred the knowledge of foreign companies to Iran, particularly in designing and equipping greenhouses. We send lots of experts to European countries to know how to grow different plants. We have regular tests on the soil and water in greenhouses. It helps us to produce healthier products, especially seedlings of roses. It means every week or month we have tests on the water, and according to its analysis, we can decide which type of fertilizers or chemicals are needed to be added to it.
According to studies, Iran is ranked 17th in the world in terms of volume, tonnage, and capacity of ornamental flowers production. But in the field of exports, it ranks 80th to 90th in the world, so there is a lot of room for improvement in that area. Every 100 rose petals is worth a barrel of oil.
We have exported large quantities of cut flowers and young roses to different countries, including Russia, in recent years. That's due to the high quality of our products, as well as the reasonable prices. Biovardosa Company has a plan to establish a tissue culture lab with a capacity of at least 5 million plants per year. It means we will produce young plants, seedlings, of different varieties of trees or other plants in Iran that are very safe, healthy, and reliable for different growers in both horticulture and agriculture businesses.
That wraps up our program for today. We always enjoy hearing from you. On behalf of the entire team, thank you for tuning in. I'll see you next time for another edition of Bazaar.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Good evening to all of our listeners. This is Iran Radio from Tehran. Nice to have you with us. I'm your presenter for the next hour. Here are some interesting facts about Islam. Muslim scholar Ibn al-Haytham, known as al-Hazen in Europe, who was born in 965 AD, formulated the scientific method and has been referred to as the world's first true scientist. He is also often regarded as the first theoretical physicist, making a significant contribution to the theory of light and optics. Additionally, he developed what is called celestial mechanics, which led to the eventual work of Europeans such as Copernicus, Galileo, Johannes Kepler, and Isaac Newton. We start off this hour's programs with Hadith of the Day. The program presents a Hadith from the Holy Prophet and members of his household, Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them, along with a brief explanation and commentary on the Hadith. Then it's time for our radio productions feature. After that, we have Leader's Speech, presenting an English translation of a selection of the statements and speeches of the Honorable Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei. And we round up this hour's programs with Spotlight, a program which covers the most important events happening in the world today. Stay with us.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no.
listening to the program Hadith of the Day on Iran Radio with Sheikh Danish.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, dear brothers and sisters, salam, and welcome to this episode of the Hadith of the Day. So today we reflect on a profound saying of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his holy progeny. He's quoted to have said, when Allah desires the survival and growth of a community, he grants them moderation and chastity. But when he wills their downfall, he opens for them the door of betrayal. So this hadith offers us a roadmap, what makes societies prosper and what leads them to collapse. Let's begin with moderation. In psychology, moderation is strongly linked to resilience. A 2021 study published in Frontiers in Psychology showed that individuals who practice balance in their habits, whether in eating, spending, or even in using social media, have lower stress levels and stronger relationships. Imagine a family where spending is balanced. They live simply, save wisely, and avoid debt. Such moderation creates stability, and stability is the soil in which growth happens. And the hadith also emphasizes afaf, or chastity. Beyond its personal meaning, chastity also represents integrity and purity in social dealings. Modern sociology confirms this, that societies that value honesty and self-restraint tend to have higher trust levels. For example, a 2019 World Bank report highlighted that communities with higher trust enjoy better economic development, because businesses, governments, and families can rely on one another. Trust, born from integrity, is the invisible glue holding societies together. Now, let's look at the other side, betrayal. Betrayal can appear in many forms. Corruption in government, dishonesty in business, and even disloyalty within families. History gives us painful lessons. Take the fall of the Roman Empire. Historians note that the internal corruption and betrayal of values played as much a role in their decline as external invasions. Modern science echoes this too. Neuroscience research shows that betrayal not